An international call to action to stop the fires burning through Brazil's Amazon.
This is a new chapter in international relations. This has never happened before, that the international community considers the policy, the environmental policy in a particular country, a national security threat.
The fires are sure to come up at the G7 summit in France. Trump wants to make it the G8 again, with Russia back in the mix.
Obviously, I think it's adverse to American national interests, but I also don't even understand how it serves Trump's personal interests.
I'm Marco Werman. Also, new British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is stepping onto the world stage and pouring on the charm.
Thank you so much for that amazing welcome that I've just had. I don't think I've had one like it in my life.
All today, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thanks very much for joining us this Friday. In the Amazon region of Brazil, the Mura indigenous people have been fighting to preserve the rainforest for a long time. Tribal leader Handek Wakanamura says the lives of his people are deeply connected with the forest. That's why the wildfires now raging through huge parts of rainforest there are a nightmare scenario.
With each passing day, we see the destruction advance. Deforestation, invasion, logging. We are sad because the forest is dying. At every moment, we feel the climate changing, and the world needs the forest. We need it, and our children need it.
The Amazon wildfires are shocking and threatening, not only for Brazil. That is a quote from a government spokesman in Germany today. Oliver Stunkel is a professor at the Getulio Vargas Foundation in Sao Paulo, Brazil. So, Oliver, that quote from Germany about Brazil is significant because both Germany and France are part of the G7 summit this weekend. They want Brazil's wildfires on the agenda. What has been the response in Brazil to this urgent call from Germany and France?
In Brazil, I would say there's been, of course, a mixed response. I mean, the government in particular is very much aligned with a traditional way of thinking about the Amazon, very much in terms not of climate change, but actually in terms of sovereignty, protecting the forest, not from destruction, but actually from outside intervention. So there's a long-standing fear, and now this has come to the fore again. And the president of Brazil, Bolsonaro, has been very clear to reject sort of any kind of criticism and saying this is part of conspiracy. He also questions the data that actually the Brazilian government itself has produced on deforestation, which has led to the ouster of one of the scientists who has led this effort. The opposition, of course, has been very critical. Indigenous populations and, interestingly enough, agribusiness, very worried because there is a growing consensus among economists, among politicians, that this situation may actually lead to consumer boycotts against Brazilian products. But the president so far has been very clear that he's unwilling to take more active action against climate change. Bolsonaro himself does not believe in climate change.
Are you able, though, to draw a line directly from his policies to the massive wildfires we're seeing right now?
Well, I mean, I think there's two sets of things. The first is he has actively undermined the bureaucracy that previous governments had set up to monitor deforestation, to disincentivize deforestation, to punish illegal logging. He's openly sort of questioned the rationale behind his policies. But it's just one element. I think the wildfires are a symbol of a much larger problem that at this stage, this government in Brazil is unwilling to invest in protecting the Amazon. So in that sense, the deforestation has been increasing massively over the past 8 months. And I think worse is to come. I mean, a lot of this is just beginning now. And this is a new chapter in international relations. This has never happened before, that the international community considers the environmental policy of a particular country a national security threat. And I think the government of Brazil is for the first time facing this international backlash. At this stage, I don't expect Brazil's climate policy to change in the near or medium term.
Meanwhile, Oliver, the fires continue to burn and the skies are just filled with smoke. What plans does the Brazilian government have right now to fight and contain these fires?
The government has set up a crisis committee, but that's more in reaction to sort of the international outcry. The government will, of course, seek to reduce the impact that's visible to the entire population. Last week in Sao Paulo, we had dark skies. It felt like it was nighttime at about 2 p.m. suddenly because there was clouds and mixed with ashes from the forest burning. And this was a very powerful moment when a lot of people just looked up and said, you know, why is it dark? This brought this home to many people. And even though local governments can, to some extent, address the situation, I'm quite pessimistic that without the help of federal government, Brazil can make much progress on this front.
Oliver Stunkel with the Getúlio Vargas Foundation in Sao Paulo, Brazil. Thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you.
The record number of fires in the Amazon is only one of many things expected to come up at the G7 this weekend in France. President Trump will be there. President Vladimir Putin of Russia will not. Russia used to be a member of the bloc, formerly known as the G8, but it was kicked out in 2014 after the Russians annexed the Crimean Peninsula from Ukraine. President Trump says he wants Putin's Russia back at the table. Michael McFaul was the U.S. ambassador to Russia during the Obama administration. Ambassador, thanks for being with us again.
Sure. Glad to be here.
So I want to start by getting your take on what President Trump had to say about Russia and the G7. Here he is speaking to reporters in the Oval Office earlier this week.
I think it's much more appropriate to have Russia in. It should be the G8 because a lot of the things we talk about have to do with Russia. So I could certainly see it being the G8 again. And if somebody would make that motion, I would certainly be disposed to think about it very favorably.
I mean, this is not the first time Trump has made the suggestion. What do you make of it?
Marco, I honestly don't understand it. I don't understand what national security interest he is seeking to advance by making that statement. Obviously, the rest of the G7 is not going to go along with it. There was a reason Vladimir Putin was kicked out of the G7. He invaded Ukraine. He annexed Crimea, and that was part of the punishment, and he showed no signs of leaving Ukraine. But secondly, I don't even understand like what he thinks he's accomplishing with Vladimir Putin. Vladimir Putin has made no signals that he wants to join the G7 or G8 again. And I just think it makes the president of the United States of America look weak.
President Putin sat down with French President Emmanuel Macron earlier this week and floated the idea of Russia rejoining the group, but with some conditions, the conditions that Macron suggested, namely that there needs to be movement to end the conflict in Ukraine. So are you opposed to an invitation to join the G7 with some conditions?
No, I'm not opposed to that. Not just some conditions, necessary conditions. And I'm not optimistic that Putin would meet them. And I want to remind your listeners, Russia joined the G7 when Russia was on the road to becoming a democracy and integrating into the West. And for several years now, they've been moving in an opposite direction. So if Russia, for some reason, after the Putin era, would move back towards embracing democratic ideas and enhancing democratic institutions and integrating into the West, that's the right time to have that conversation. But just to bring them back in without them changing their behavior, I don't think that serves America's national interest.
Well, speaking of American national interest, there have been all these attempts over the past, 20 years under Putin at resetting diplomatic relations with Russia. Mostly they have seemed to fail, including under Obama when you were ambassador. Why?
Well, Marco, I see that history a little more with a lot more variation. I don't think it's been consistent failure. In the first years of the reset between President Obama and President Medvedev, right, it wasn't President Putin, we accomplished concrete things. We signed the New START Treaty, getting rid of 30% of the nuclear weapons in the world. We got new sanctions, multilateral sanctions on Iran. We got new supply routes to Afghanistan. All of those things, it's not about good relations, bad relations. I think this is a big misunderstanding about diplomacy. Obama engaged Medvedev to achieve concrete outcomes that President Obama believed were in America's national interest. And when we look today to President Trump's engagement with Putin, I'm hard-pressed to think of one concrete outcome as a result of the happy talk that the two of them have now that has been good for the United States.
So take the Medvedev relationship out of the mix. I mean, do you think the answer to why several resets, maybe not all of them, have not succeeded, is the answer Putin?
Yes. I think a lot of it is about Putin's mindset. And fundamentally, he believes that the United States is an enemy of Russia. He believes that the United States is out to thwart Russian power and violate Russian sovereignty. You know, I dealt with him upfront and personal on this. If you have that mindset about us, it's very difficult to find, win-win outcomes in dealing with Putin right now.
Michael McFaul was U.S. ambassador to Russia during the Obama administration. He's now at Stanford University. Thanks very much, Michael.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
One of the big topics they'll be talking about at this year's G7 is economic inclusion, which has more than a hint of irony for Britain's new Prime Minister, Boris Johnson. That's because job number one for Johnson is to prepare for Great Britain's exit from the European Union. From London, here's the world's Orla Barry.
For 4 weeks, Boris Johnson has avoided meeting his EU counterparts. That's because of Brexit. Neither side has a quick answer for Johnson's biggest challenge as Prime Minister, exiting the EU. All this week, Johnson is charging through meetings with a host of foreign leaders. First, there was Angela Merkel in Berlin.
Chancellor Angela, thank you so much for that amazing welcome that I've just had. I don't think I've had one like it in my life. And
the German leader, for her part, was equally pleasant.
Ja, meine Damen und Herren, ich freue mich,
and I'm delighted to have the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson here in Berlin. I would like to bid him a very warm welcome indeed.
It wasn't long before that warmth turned to the issue that has dominated EU talks for 3 years. Merkel gave Johnson what some see as a sliver of hope that there might be a way out of the worst-case no-deal Brexit scenario that the UK appears to be hurtling towards. A one-month offer to find an alternative to the infamous Irish backstop. That's effectively an insurance plan to prevent the return to a hard border in Ireland.
The backstop has always been a fallback position if one is able to solve this conundrum. We said we will probably find it in the next 2 years to come, but we can also maybe find it in the next 30 days. So then we are one step further in the right direction.
Johnson once again repeated his hardline message that the UK is leaving the European Union at the end of October, come what may.
And that is why we must come out of the EU on October the 31st, deal or no deal.
Next, it was off to Paris and a meeting with the French president. Of all EU leaders, Emmanuel Macron has been the toughest in his approach to the Brexit talks. All predictions were that Johnson would get a frosty reception at the Elysee Palace. In front of the cameras, it was anything but. Macron even joked about his tough guy image.
I've always been presented as the hardest one in the group.
Despite the jokes, Macron stood his ground by refusing to renegotiate the EU's position on Brexit. All the while, Johnson was at pains to play up the relationship between the two countries.
With Brexit, it is our joint ambition, UK and France, that we should deepen and intensify our economic interpenetration. And just as French buses, I'm proud to say, ply the streets of London, it is also a stunning fact that your beautiful TGVs run on steel railways made in Scunthorpe by British Steel.
Beyond the bus and train diplomacy, there was no real progress from the meetings. But Johnson's administration back home is likely happy. After all, this is a man with a reputation for blunders. And both of these trips were relatively gaffe-free. This weekend, Johnson makes his debut on the world stage at the G7 summit. Brexit is not on the agenda, although it will surely be a topic on the sidelines. The British Prime Minister will meet with several world leaders. But here in the UK, people will be watching closely the dynamic between Johnson and President Trump. Earlier this week, the American president praised Johnson for the way he's been dealing with the Europeans.
They have not treated the UK very well. That's a very tough bargain they're driving, the European Union. It's a very tough bargain. And I think that UK has the right man in charge right now, the right person in charge, in the form of Boris.
Johnson knows, though, that a closer alliance with the US over Europe comes with a price. The Iran nuclear deal and Britain's relationship with Russia and China could become more complicated if Johnson continues to cozy up with the Trump administration. But for the moment, Boris Johnson is up against a tight deadline. He has 9 weeks to tackle the problem that sunk Britain's last two prime ministers. And that's Brexit. For the world, I'm Orla Barry in London.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. An explosion in Iraq this week is raising some big questions. It was from a drone attack firing on a cache of weapons that belonged to an Iraqi militia supported by Iran. Several parties are involved here. News reports say the drone was piloted by Israel. It's apparently not the first such airstrike.
So we're basically looking at a serious escalation happening in Iraq. Since July 19th, we've seen four explosions.
Joyce Karem has been covering the story for the National News Agency, which is based in the United Arab Emirates.
So, Marco, on Tuesday, 8 p.m. Baghdad time, another report of an explosion in Iraq hitting an ammunition warehouse that belongs to a pro-Iran militia. Since then, we've seen all fingers pointing on Israel as being responsible for the attack. Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu, speaking from Ukraine, did not deny responsibility, but he also did not confirm it either.
So a pro-Iran militia inside Iraq, who uses these Iranian weapons in this cache? What are they for?
Well, these militias have sprouted after the U.S. invasion of Iraq, and they have acquired sophisticated weaponry from Iran. The U.S. and Israel monitor these weaponry transfers. They've initially used some in the fight against ISIS, but they mainly use them as non-state actors, and they are a major threat inside Iraq and regionally and to Israel.
So Bibi Netanyahu has not denied or confirmed that this happened. But does it follow the pattern of Israel just being concerned about Iran wherever Iran is in the Mideast?
Precisely. And that's what he said. Iran will have no immunity anywhere in the Middle East. And the attack itself, the strikes, they fit a pattern that Israel has been following in hitting Iranian proxies, whether in Syria or Iraq. Now, what this brings to the conversation is there are U.S. troops in Iraq. These militias have threatened not to retaliate against Israel, but to retaliate against U.S. interests and bases in Iraq territory.
Yeah, remind us what the U.S. interests are in Iraq right now.
The U.S. has several thousand troops in Iraq. There are joint bases with the Iraqi government in several areas in Iraq. Some are very close to where these explosions happen. These same militias have said it openly that they want the U.S. to leave Iraq. But the U.S. is there mainly for the fight against terrorism, the fight against ISIS, Al-Qaeda, also to secure its regional interests.
I mean, there's another question, too. Why did the Iraqi military not handle this?
It's incapable. The Iraqi military, the functions of the Iraqi state after the war have been weakened. The state itself is fragmented.
If there's concern in Israel about Iran, why was this a military strike? Was diplomacy not an option?
Because there is no diplomatic ties between Israel and Iran. There is no diplomacy happening in Iraq or Syria or Yemen or Libya. I mean, you name it. There is very little conflict resolution and diplomatic efforts going effectively into several Middle East arenas today.
So you said there's been a series of these strikes. What are you going to be looking for next in assessing where this goes?
The latest we've heard from Iraq is one of these militias has threatened the U.S. if one more strike occurs. So we were all watching to see if another explosion, mysterious explosion happens in Iraq, and who will bear the consequences of that. Will it be U.S. assets in Iraq? Will it be U.S. allies' assets in Iraq? We don't know yet. So that's what we're watching. And, you know, keeping an eye on the Middle East, you don't know what front is going to just explode at what time.
Joyce Karem with The National, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks, Marco.
There's a small town in Belgium called Ath, A-T-H, and today the Ducasse d'Ath Festival kicks off. It's a tradition that goes back hundreds of years. It was even put on the Intangible Cultural Heritage List by UNESCO, the UN's cultural agency. The festival includes a parade with 22 characters riding on floats, each one representing some type of historical or religious figure. Enter the controversy. One of these characters is called the Savage, and there's a campaign to have him removed. The World's Sarah Birnbaum has more.
A float that looks like a ship snakes through the streets, and a white guy in blackface and full body black makeup is chained to the bow. This is the Savage, and the makeup is only the half of it. He has a ring through his nose, a feather headdress, a loincloth, and shackles. He strains against the chains and cries out. crowd eats it up. The parade goes back to medieval times, but the savage character was introduced in the 1870s, just before Belgium's King Leopold laid claim to the Congo and began a long and brutal colonial era. Mouhad Raghif is the spokesperson for the anti-racism group Brussels Panthers. He says the savage is hard to watch.
It's just horrible.
Raghif's group sent a letter to UNESCO asking them to revoke the festival's special designation. Activists and academics have signed on. Raghif says they're still waiting for an answer, but the whole tradition of the savage needs to go.
I have a friend, she's black, living in Att, and it happened to her that she's walking in the street and she meets a couple or a mom with her kids, and one of the kids starts crying because he sees her. And she's black, and she reminds him of the savage. Or they ask her, can I have a savage kiss?
Laurent Dubuisson is a historian on the tourism board in the town of Ath. He says the savage isn't supposed to be racist.
We were very surprised by the controversy. People think we're racist, but we don't have the impression that we are at all.
Dubuisson says, sure, the character started in colonial times, but it has evolved since then.
Today, when the people of Oth look at the character, they don't see an African or a foreigner. The savage is the star of our festival, and he's a pretend character who can evoke lots of different countries and origins.
Blackface is actually pretty common in Belgium. It's part of a popular Christmas time tradition. You'll see it at festivals. A couple of years ago, the Belgian foreign minister, who's the equivalent of their secretary of state, dressed up in blackface at a rally. And this month, the country's Africa Museum hosted a party and some guests showed up in blackface. But the difference between now and, let's say, 10 years ago is that now there's a public debate around it. Laura Senyumva is an activist and artist. She says children of immigrants are leading the way. She herself is Belgian of Rwandan descent.
So me, my parents, for example, they came to Belgium with a different mindset. They were there for work and they wanted to go back. But the following generation, we were born there. We are fully Belgian. We feel not entitled, but we just have the right to be considered fully part of this society, I think.
And therefore, she says, it's time to put an offensive tradition like the savage to rest. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
I'm Marco Werman. President Trump says American Jews who don't vote Republican are disloyal. That sparked a debate about anti-Semitism.
The question is, do Jews feel safe in your country? And the answer here is no.
Plus, bluegrass music finds a new home in Buenos Aires.
This could not be any less of a bluegrass place.
All still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, PRI, and PRX. The subject of anti-Semitism was back in the news this week in a big way. It started a couple of weeks ago when Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, at the suggestion of President Trump, decided to bar two Democratic congresswomen from visiting Israel, Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib. Things escalated soon after that when Trump fired off a series of tweets that many saw as anti-Semitic. The president also claimed that American Jews who vote for Democrats were disloyal. How did all of this resonate in Israel? Aaron Lerman served on Israel's National Security Council. We reached him outside Tel Aviv on his mobile phone.
Well, to the best of my understanding, both Israel and the United States are still republics. And while there are many people in Israel who are deeply appreciative of the president's position, I think, and there's quite a lot of friendly sentiment towards President Trump, I think it's very important for us to retain our sovereignty. And in this situation, I think some of the language has gone too far.
So let me bring into the conversation Batya Ungar-Sargon. She joins us from New York, where she is the opinion editor at The Forward, a news organization for a Jewish American audience. I mean, Donald Trump has been called anti-Semitic, but so have Democrats, Representatives Omar and Tlaib. So do you see them as spurring hate for Israel?
I'm really glad you brought that up. We can't really compare because there have been mass murders by people quoting Donald Trump and quoting neo-Nazis and quoting white supremacists. So the anti-Semitism on the right has had a much deadlier force. At the same time, when you have two congresswomen who say anti-Semitic things, at that point, the Jewish community starts to feel truly abandoned. I don't think they're anti-Semites. I don't think about people that way. The question is, do Jews feel safe in your country? And the answer here is no.
So, Batya, what do you think? Has the Trump White House taken a positive approach to diplomacy with Israel?
You know, as an American Jew, I feel very strongly the need that Israel end its occupation of the Palestinians and grant the Palestinians living in the West Bank civil rights. So to me, what Trump has done is he has enabled Netanyahu to pursue the exact opposite, to pursue his worst ethno-nationalist tendencies. And to me, that is not good for Israel and it's not good for the Jews.
So Aaron Lerman, what does loyalty from American Jews look like for you?
Yes, I think we need Jewish people on both sides of the Atlantic, the two largest communities, to remain united around some fundamental elements. And these should include respect for the sovereignty of both nations. And I may dispute Batya's claim that most American Jews feel horrified by Israel's stance. Given the immense efforts that were made to make peace with the Palestinians in recent years and the terrible wave of terror that engulfed our country in the previous decade, all of these are experiences unique to Israelis and shape Israeli perspectives, but we must not allow political expediency to drive us apart.
Batya, what attitudes do you think American Jews should have toward Israel?
I'm not sure if I have a view about what they should be, but I can tell you what they are. 92% of American Jews say that they are pro-Israel. For a long time, Israel was sort of the beating heart of American Jewish identity. In the last 2 years, because Trump is so anathema to American Jews, that has weakened because he's so close to Israel. The stain of the Trump administration has started to spread onto American Jews' most beloved entity in this world, which is the Jewish state. And that's been truly heartbreaking. And I just want to say also, there's been this effect where the Jewish community has started to raise its voice up more on behalf of the Palestinians as a result of this close partnership that is so horrifying to us. And that's why it's so disappointing to see Congress members bringing up this issue that we want to see raised. We want to hear justice for the Palestinians raised. But they bring it up and then they allow anti-Semitic comments to sort of seep into the conversation. And that is really a shame. I think it's a true betrayal of Jewish Americans, all Americans, and the Palestinians as well.
So Batya and Aaron, as you kind of think about each other's positions on this, and as one country, Israel, looks at another country, the United States, and vice versa, do either of you question either side's right to kind of bring any of this stuff up?
I would say that the closeness of the American Jewish community to Israel certainly gives them the right to voice their opinion. But at the end of the day, we are the ones who live in a very dangerous area under circumstances that most American Jews cannot possibly imagine. The country right next to us, Syria, has been burned to a crisp by its own rulers, with 500,000 dead within the last 8 years. So we live in a neighborhood where we must ultimately make our own decisions. And for both people in America who love Israel but criticize its policies, and a president who supports Israel and then uses the Israeli issue as a wedge in American politics, I wish on both sides that they would be more respectful towards the extreme concerns that we have where we live.
And what about you, Batya?
Okay, so I don't disagree with what Dr. Lerman said. I want to just bring up that the Second Intifada ended less than 20 years ago 1,038 Israelis were murdered, and about 3/4 of them were civilians. That is the equivalent of 50,000 Americans being murdered to terrorism. That is a huge wound that was opened in the Israeli psyche that is not yet closed. And we should be respectful of that, and we should be humble before that huge tragedy. At the same time, they don't get to see the true effects of the occupation on daily Palestinian life. And those effects are horrifying. And as an American Jew, I've been many times, and I believe that it is our job in a way to be the conscience and the eyes and the ears and to bring what we've seen back to Israelis so that this feels more urgent to them. I don't think Israelis want to be occupying another nation, but it doesn't feel urgent to them to solve it because they don't see it. And in that sense, I feel that we do have an ethical responsibility here to teach our brothers and sisters what we can see.
Bhatia Angarsargon in New York, where she's the opinion editor at The Forward. Also with us, Aaron Lerman, who served on Israel's National Security Council, speaking with us from Israel, not far from Tel Aviv. Thank you both very much.
Wow, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you very much for having us.
In Zimbabwe, being funny appears to be a dangerous business. Actor and comedian Samantha Correa plays the character of Gonyeti in a satirical video series that airs on TV in Zimbabwe.
1 year, chairo chairo gore, murumogwe asatatu jigone mchenge asataputik.
And here's Samantha Correa yesterday, not in a satirical video, but speaking instead from a hospital bed. She was recovering after being abducted and beaten. Correa is with Bus Stop TV, an entertainment company in Zimbabwe that puts out satirical videos that poke fun at life in the country. The World's Carol Hills keeps a close eye on global satire and has been looking into this. So, Carol, what happened exactly?
Well, Marco, there's this woman. Her name is Samantha Correa, but she's really known by her character's name, which is Gonyeti. And she appears in these satirical videos, which are really popular. And they're on this channel in Zimbabwe called Bus Stop TV. This channel's been testing the limits of free expression and what they can really talk about since President Robert Mugabe, longtime leader of Zimbabwe, stepped down. And so she plays all sorts of things like a policeman in one skit or a housewife in another, and they very indirectly poke fun at the government.
So what happened to her?
It's pretty scary and pretty gruesome. I mean, Correa was at home Wednesday night around 9 p.m. She heard a knock at the door. And today in an interview, you know, her colleague, Sharon Chideyu, who's a fellow comedian, described what happened.
Some masked gunmen came to her house. They knocked on the door and they said they were police. But the moment they opened the door, they realized that they were men with guns wearing masks. They dragged her out. She was wearing just her top and her underwear. And they shoved her into a vehicle that was parked outside, and they drove off with her.
And then Chideyu says that the men drove Correa to this place where there was sewer water flowing. And the men said to her, "You mock the government, and we've been monitoring you." And then they basically told her to kind of simulate army drills, and they had her roll around in the sewer water.
So, Carol, what's going on here? Because I think a lot of our listeners will remember kind of the last pivot point in Zimbabwe was that ouster of the longtime dictator Mugabe. Wasn't Zimbabwe supposed to be in a less repressive place at this point? Pluralism, maybe even a move toward democracy.
That's what Zimbabweans were hoping for. And so these satirists kept producing these videos, but they still wanted to go ahead and try to illustrate what life was like in Zimbabwe. They've gotten in trouble. They did a skit involving police. Two actors are in it, including Samantha Correa. Her colleague, a fellow comedian, is being interviewed by a reporter saying, "We've heard all these reports of police brutality." And she's saying, "Oh, no, that's just the foreign press. There's nothing happening here." But in the background is Samantha Correa playing Gonyeti, beating up these two young men. And so people interpreted that as, you're going after the government. And at the time of that police video, she was warned that her comedy was becoming too political.
Is there any evidence that the thugs who abducted Correa this week are any way connected to the ruling government? And has the government responded to this event?
There isn't specific direct evidence, but there are reports that the car that drove away with her on Wednesday night was the same car used in other kinds of attacks on people considered critical of the government. The Ministry of Information put out a cursory statement just saying that the matter is now in the hands of the police, that they're investigating this case of kidnapping and assault. But it was quite brief.
So what is next for Correa and this Bus Stop TV group that does these satirical videos?
Well, at this point, they're going to lay low. Correa herself, it's not clear where she is right now. She's recuperating somewhere. But they're saying they're not going away. They're going to be back.
The World Satire Watcher, Carol Hills, with her eyes on Zimbabwe today. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
If you happen to be in Oulu in northern Finland today, you've got a few activities to choose from. You can visit their world-class science museum, go to Nalikari, the beach. It is still summer after all. But I think you'd be best advised to check out the annual Air Guitar World Championship in Oulu. It cranks up there today. The World's Diego Lopez has a story.
It's got a lot of what you'd expect. Wild jumping, energetic strumming, and hands racing up and down an invisible guitar neck. That's Eric Mean Moline, shredding to the song TNT Diet by Michael Monroe. Moline is an air guitar world champion himself.
It's this amazing thing that's gone from a private thing that people do in their bedrooms to a huge piece of one-minute performance art set to music. The Air Guitar World Championships is the biggest adrenaline rush of all time.
Moline says it's a mind-blowing type of performance.
So you are backstage and they're about to throw you out there in front of 9,000 people and outside in this town square, the Rotwari, and the people are going nuts. They have a huge stage set up with lights going everywhere and smoke and big TV screens, and the whole thing is live streamed on the internet.
So how did air guitar become a global thing in the first place?
It started out as kind of a somewhat local competition, although they had competitors from other countries, so they kind of jokingly called it the World Air Guitar Championships.
Bird McDaniel is an ethnomusicologist at Northeastern University. He served as a judge at this year's National Air Guitar Championship here in the U.S.
The competition has gradually gained momentum. There was a publication of a documentary called Air Guitar Nation, and there was also a memoir that an American air guitarist wrote called To Air Is Human, and those really catalyzed the U.S. air guitar scene, but they also kind of gave credibility to this international practice.
And while all this sounds like just a good time, the organizers of the Air Guitar Championships want it to be about more than just rocking out.
This year, they have a symposium for climate change and world peace, for example, and they're making that part of the official weekend's activities for air guitarists from all over the world to emphasize the importance of climate change concerns on a global perspective.
Well, that's nice. But Marco, if you'll excuse me, I have some practicing to do for next year's World Championship. For the world, I'm Diego Lopez.
I wish you could see Diego tearing up the frets. Absolutely uncontrollable. Actually, I wish I could see that too. It is not unusual to see parents take their kids to a local parade, a march, or even a peaceful demonstration. But in Moscow, there's one couple that might lose custody of their two children for doing just that. The BBC's Sarah Rainsford in the Russian capital has more.
The case stems from this march through central Moscow back in July. The crowd was chanting for fair elections. It was part of the biggest wave of opposition protests here in years, and they haven't stopped. But this one wasn't authorised, and when protesters refused to disperse, over 1,000 were detained and many beaten by police. Baby Artemy's parents were in the city centre that day, but they tell me they left for a quieter spot as soon as they saw the riot police.
Actually, we didn't see any disorders, any dangerous or aggressive situations.
A few days later, though, this YouTube video was being shown on state television, complete with sinister soundtrack. It labelled the protests as a pogrom, and it singled out Olga and Dmitry. It claimed that they had handed their baby to the protest leader to help him escape from police. Investigators opened a criminal case for endangering the child.
It's really insane.
Sergei Famin, the man on the video, is Olga's cousin. She says they all went home together that day and there were no police to be seen. Still, Sergei eventually called the police to turn himself in for questioning. Olga's cousin is now one of a dozen protesters facing long prison sentences for rioting, though almost all the violence at these opposition protests has come from police. But for Olga and Dmitry, it doesn't end there. Moscow prosecutors have since applied to the courts to take both their children into care, and all because of that same video on YouTube.
It's actually extremely cruel punishing our kids because we are good parents.
The family are now in a nervous wait for their court hearing, as prosecutors warn they're checking other parents who may have taken their children to the protests.
That's the BBC's Sarah Rainsford in Moscow. This is the creation of Joe Troop and Friends, the product of a musical mission to give bluegrass a Latin twist. Joe is from the Blue Ridge Mountains of North Carolina, so bluegrass runs through his veins. In 2010, after a bout of global wanderlust, Joe moved to Buenos Aires to be a bluegrass music teacher, a kind of crazy idea, he admits. But he had some notably talented students from Argentina and Mexico. Together, they formed a band, Che Apalache. Their new album is Rearrange My Heart, and Joe Troop told me what they're up to.
For the first 5 or 6 years of our existence, all that we did was play Appalachian folk music, and that seemed amazingly avant-garde to have a bluegrass band in the city of Buenos Aires, Argentina. I mean, it's just, if you live there, you're like, this could not be any less of a bluegrass place. And they brought to the table their natural selves, you know, the soundtrack of their lives is, you know, candombe, tango, milonga, murga, cumbia, all these things that you just hear on the street or you hear in your school or at dance parties, you know. So when we started doing that, everything just started flowing and it was like this mystical transformation.
So you call this Latin grass or azur grass? I mean, what's the word?
Yeah, Latin grass was a good marketing terminology that Paul, the Artican Mex guy, came up with. And we were like, oh, that's great. And it's a good thing he came up with that word because it helped to fuel the band's identity in the United States.
Shepherds would roam o'er so harsh a land.
I guess if we can think of this album, Rearrange My Heart, as a bluegrass album, it also upends bluegrass themes. There's a track called The Wall. I think we know what that's about. There's also another song you wrote called The Dreamer. And that song was inspired by a friend of yours, Moises Serrano, a DACA recipient and a star in this 2016 documentary, Forbidden, Undocumented and Queer in Rural America. What was it about Moises Serrano's story that struck you?
Well, I met Moises at a conference in Charlotte, and he was a prominent voice as an out undocumented person and as an out queer person. And so I identified with, you know, I'm queer myself, so I identified with that immediately. But I saw the parallels between, you know, being an undocumented person and coming out in both ways simultaneously. It was a story that struck me as very interesting. So I basically approached him. He was sitting there with his mother at the conference. And I said, you know, this is really cool. I'd like to watch your documentary. He sent me a link. I was able to watch it. And I thought, you know, here's a guy who's in the public arena. He's a political activist. I should write a song about him and we should team up and try to, you know, change people's stance on what they call illegals, which of course that's their word, not mine. But, you know, you hear these kind of, if you're around North Carolina for long enough, you'll hear people talk about undocumented immigrants probably within a couple hours and almost always in a negative way. So I asked him for permission at some point last year. Hey, can I write a song about you? And he's like, yeah.
Ay, 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 mi corazón, venga nuestra salvación.
Joe, in so many ways, I mean, bluegrass, the music you play, is American. And the fusion of bluegrass with Latin American music is also totally American. In these times, whether your music is political or not in its lyrics, does it feel like an act of dissent to create music that steps out of the bounds of what many people think is bluegrass?
Oh, man. Everything in the United States and in a lot of other countries, too, has fallen into the clutches of division-based politics. So the idea of Che Apalache is to tell news stories which challenge that awful narrative. Bluegrass audiences are wide-ranging, but sometimes you'll encounter hate speech at bluegrass festivals or sort of symbolism that encroaches upon other people's comfort. And I don't know, I never got down with that. And I think bluegrass when it was coming into existence, it wasn't that at all. I think it's been estranged from what it really is. You said something interesting too about how the idea of the Americas as a place. I mean, that's another thing that drew me to Argentina, is this sense of, wow, that country's similar to the United States. They're trying to forge their identity still. And I don't know, the bluegrass instrumentation even has the same issues. Like the banjo doesn't know what it is yet. It's still figuring it out. And so there's all this newness in the Americas and all these countless cultures which came together and are producing something new. And it's just fascinating. So I like the idea of being an artistic Americanist and trying to create an artistic dialogue between all of these places.
Joe Troop, co-founder of the quartet Che Apalache, thanks very much for being with us. Great to meet you.
Nice to meet you too, Marco.
Maria, Maria del agua, Maria del cielo, qué linda Maria. Maria, Maria divina, qué suerte que tuve tenerte en mi vida.
That is some really sweet stuff. That'll do it for us this Friday. The World's Theme Music was composed by Ned Porter. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Have a great weekend, everyone. We'll be back with you here on Monday.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.